Coming up on Weekend America.
Martin Luther King risked everything for civil rights, but he upped the ante by fighting poverty.
I had a call from Martin Luther King. He said, this may be my last campaign, and we're going for broke. That was an indication that Martin Luther King was putting everything on the line.
A gamble on Resurrection City 40 years ago this week. I'm Bill Radke. Also this weekend, a mom remembers when her son discovered her latest purchase.
Yes, we did think it was pretty funny the way you said, holy s***, there's a bike in our garage.
We bring you a story about a real motorcycle mama. And some traditions are easier to pass on than others.
Why do you think these guys love tractors so much?
It's just something we like to see carried on.
Do you think it'll be carried on?
I don't know.
Big boys who love their big wheels after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. Des Cooper is away this week. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. This weekend in America, superdelegates are deciding whether to jump. There's a mother-daughter look-alike contest in Omaha, just one of many Mother's Day events this weekend. And there's a tractor race in Wisconsin, object to go as slowly as you can. And we'll take you there in the fullness of time. What are you doing this weekend?
I am going to a Latin jazz show at the Greek Theater in L.A.
This weekend I'm going to a Red Sox game.
I am actually going to a wedding on Saturday.
I'm
going to
play the piano all day Saturday and hang out and just do nothing on Sunday probably.
I'm going to grade 20 papers for my spring course. And I'm going to do baby massage for this little person.
I am visiting my mother for the weekend. It is Mother's Day, so I'm going up to cook dinner and breakfast for her and maybe take her to a movie.
Those voices came to us from Ann Arbor, Los Angeles, and Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Weekend America. Today we begin a new series called This Weekend in 1968. We're looking at events that happened 40 years ago in politics, arts, and science, and how those events still affect us today.
68 was like an earthquake.
The country was not on the cusp of revolution.
There appeared to be as many policemen as demonstrators.
But it was certainly on the cusp of some enormous millennial change.
We hear you loud and clear, boy.
It still does resonate even when people don't realize that it's resonating.
40 years ago on this weekend, in 1968, men and women from all over the country were arriving in Washington, D.C. They were coming for the Poor People's Campaign. The campaign was the last movement organized by Martin Luther King Jr. before his assassination. King's vision was to bring together poor people of all races to make the plight of poverty visible. It was going to be not a sit-in, but a live-in. They built Resurrection City on the Mall. The legacy of this city's rise and fall lives today, as its organizers will tell you. Dr. Bernard Lafayette was one of them. This is his story.
I got a call from Martin Luther King. This was in 67. He said, I need you to come down to Atlanta and to move here and work full time. This may be my last campaign, and we're going for broke. And when I got to Atlanta, he appointed me the national coordinator for the Poor People's Campaign. Now, the idea originally came from Marion Wright Edelman.
I was Marion Wright back in 1968. I had been working with Robert Kennedy on hunger in Mississippi, and he told me to tell Dr. King to bring the poor to Washington, to make them visible.
And the idea was that we would bring those people in front of the folk who make decisions and build this tent city and camp out until you get what you want. The two of us were talking. I said to Martin Luther King, well, we say this is a poor people's campaign. Black people are not the only ones poor. Are you talking about getting Hispanics involved? He said, yes. I said, what about Native Americans? He said, yes. So I was getting to the final question, and that was the poor whites from Appalachia. He say, are they poor? I said, yes. He say, if they were poor, then this was their campaign.
And so the planning began.
And I've been to the mountaintop. Today I have a dream. Don't you ever forget. getting words of Martin Luther King.
I was with Martin Luther King on April 4th, 1968. I was there at the Lorraine Hotel in his room, 306. And that morning, we were talking about the details now of the Poor People's Campaign and the press conference we're going to have in Washington, D.C.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please?
So I got on a plane 5 hours later. He was assassinated.
Martin Luther King, 20 minutes ago, died.
My name is Walter Fauntroy.
Reverend Walter Fauntroy was the man who was operating between the government and the poor people.
Started out under the leadership of Martin Luther King.
And it took all that we could to say they killed,
you may have killed
the dreamer.
The dreamer, but you cannot kill the dream.
Come to Washington. So they came with some hope.
We're 3 hours out of Washington now, so how do you feel?
Oh, I feel great.
If you miss me from the job I'm on, then you will know I'm in Washington.
People, 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 people.
They came by bus, by train.
I am the Reverend Dr. Ruby Reese Moon.
They came in a mule train from the south, and the mule trains were very slow and very hard.
We come to this sacred spot for the purpose of building a city.
Thousands and thousands of people.
I came up here to get more, because they're not paying us nothing down there for work.
From all across America.
The name of this city will be Resurrection City.
I discovered a map of Resurrection City recently that I didn't know existed, which is an aerial view.
A city of plywood, teepee-looking A-frames, houses.
It looks like a refugee camp.
I'm Stoney Cooks.
Stoney Cooks was a member of the staff.
There's some people who really made their A-frame look like home.
We gonna walk the streets of Washington.
A little family would dig up flowers and put them around their A-frame.
Between 2,000 and 5,000 people were crammed in there over the course of May and June.
I mean, literally every available spot was taken.
What's your last name?
We had full facilities for
first name?
A city.
Johnny Gilwegian.
So we had to have a mayor.
I would like to introduce to you Dr. Ralph David Abernathy.
There's adequate food, a city hall,
sewage,
healthcare, schools.
Every single day, we started with a demonstration at the Department of Agriculture.
We went to Mr. Freeman at the Department of Agriculture.
And then we branch out from there.
And demanded that the hunger of this nation be fed.
People were organized in their areas of interest. If you were an Indian, you wanted to go to the interior. Talk to people in need affairs. Let them know that policy needs to change. If you were a farmer, you went to agriculture. So it went well early on.
He said he's rich and you're poor and fooey on you.
Some despair began to drift in when some of the people they talked to seemed nasty.
Don't talk down to the people, talk to them.
But they would always pick them up when they got back. They'd have a good hot meal and some entertainment.
Musicians came by in the evening.
Oh, my goodness.
Jimmy Collier.
Peter, Paul, and Mary.
I think Pete Seeger came.
And we got to singing.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Tell me.
So there were always visitors coming through, even when there was mud and everything else.
It may rain in Resurrection City.
Yeah.
Every day. It would be nice and bright, and then all of a sudden the clouds would come through and...
People got tired of living in the wet.
There were even rumors that the government seeded the clouds.
Somebody counted, and they said it rained 40 days.
Which amplified the despair. And when you got a muddy spirit and a muddy eyes and a muddy future, you turn on one another instead of to one another.
We had robbery, burglary.
Stoney probably didn't tell you this, but... Some guy came in to rob Stoney, and Stoney gave the person the impression that he was going to give him the money, but instead Stoney knocked the gun out of his hand and the barrel of the gun fell out.
It was 4,000 or 5,000 people and all of their problems.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at
June the 5th, 1968.
Today.
To hear that Robert Kennedy was assassinated, it was like, my God, again.
It was hard. People just went crazy. They were cussing out nuns who were coming every day to feed because they were white. They were turning on one another. You Hispanics taking our jobs. You Indians should have beat the cowboys. There was just a pervasive angriness.
Today we do not plead. We demand.
The leadership of the Poor People Campaign were very disgusted. They would not get in Congress to listen.
You may not respect me.
You may not respect me.
But I am.
But I am.
Somebody.
They were saying, you're going to hear us before you leave.
We're going to stay here in Resurrection City.
It was a disaster at the end. The federal government said, look, if you could control the people, put them in the kind of discipline we had when they came, fine. And all of a sudden, it just popped out.
The bulldozers came in from the 17th Street entrance.
I think it was June 24th.
People were told, move out or you're going to be crushed over.
And I went down there and watched it. Helplessly.
This was demolition. They bulldozed it over.
People I'd been talking to did not have any prior knowledge of it.
And in a very short period of time, there was no more Resurrection City.
I think Resurrection City is remembered as a failed effort, that even its failure lifted us to higher ground.
We have shown this government that the poor are bad.
I think that's how I view it.
Whether in the poverty, the answer is no.
Change is a long, hard thing.
This is reality, not a dream. This is life.
Martin put it this way. The arc of the moral universe is long. But always bends toward justice.
And I think it's really important for people to know that while they went back home in despair and depressed, a lot of follow-up occurred, which did lead to major, major federal investment in nationwide nutrition programs like food stamps and school lunches. So the Poor People's Campaign struggle was not in vain.
I look back on the Poor People's Campaign in that decade, as painful as it was, as what was necessary to awaken enough people to change public policy. We shall overcome. Deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome. And that's that.
Everybody's campaign failed. We all go down in jail. Everybody's got a right to live.
Our series, This Weekend in 1968, is produced by Ann Happerman and Kara Oler. Special thanks to the Pacifica Archives for sounds from Resurrection City. We have a multimedia slideshow for you to give you a taste of life at Resurrection City. I hope you'll come to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, she still believes in a town called Hope, and wine drinkers can't tell a pricey bottle from two Buck Charles. Good news, bad news, or no news? Next on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. Desiree Cooper is away this week. I'm Bill Radke. The human brain is not equipped to read a newspaper without some emotional judgment. That's why Zen Buddhism is hard, though paradoxically simple. So let's embrace our inner judge for a few minutes. This is Good News, Bad News, or No News. And here to slice up the news with us, joining us for the first time, New York Times food writer Mark Bittman. Welcome, Mark.
It's great to be here, Bill.
Also, our close, close dear friend, writer and comedian Dana Gould. Hey, Dana.
Good afternoon.
And canny political operative and commentator Tara Setmeyer. Hi, Tara.
Hi. Thank you for having me back.
Our first topic. Senator Hillary Clinton is surrounded by her supporters. And just outside that circle, there's another larger ring of people telling her, quit the campaign. Is her perseverance good news, bad news, or no news?
Well, it's bad news for the Democrats. I mean, as long as she stays in it, it creates chaos, which is what's going on. And they're going to have to pull this nomination from her cold, dead fingers. And that looks like the path she's going down.
How does it feel to you personally, Tara?
I revel in it. I'm on the other side. So I'm sitting back watching this because we already have a candidate with cold, dead hands. So there's nothing interesting on that side. Yeah. So this is quite entertaining. It's fascinating to watch.
How about others?
It's no news in the sense that it's not surprising. I mean, honestly, psychologically, I think you just build up so much momentum. And now, Lord knows I don't want to climb inside her. I don't want to climb inside that skull. But I think that it's kind of like, is it possible that after you run a marathon, you can't come to a dead stop when it's over? You have to keep running past the finish line because you have so much momentum.
But I have to say, although I haven't liked her for months, if not years, now I have this incredible begrudging admiration for her because she is, she's like the Terminator at this point. She is not going to die. And I think that kind of perseverance is amazing. The other thing that I can't help but thinking is that if the tables were turned right now, everybody would be saying that Obama was running a heroic campaign and should stay in the race. So I don't begrudge it. And I think the Democrats are going to come out of this pretty strong anyway, so it doesn't bother me that much.
Our next topic. A new book claims that American wine drinkers can't tell a cheap bottle from a pricey one. The author conducted taste tests in which, for example, $2 Chuck out-tested a $55 bottle of Napa Valley Cabernet. Does this sound like good news, bad news, or no news? I direct this first to New York Times food writer Mark Bittman.
If I have to choose one, it's good news.
Good news. Why is that?
Well, it's good news because I don't think people really need to worry about whether wine is expensive or cheap. I often order, if not the cheapest, then way near the bottom of the wines on the list because they're not bad. And the stuff that costs three times as much is not better.
So but you're Mark Bittman. You can get away with that.
Well, all right, fine. What can I say to that?
If I were on a date with you and you ordered the cheapest wine, I would be...
You'd think I was cool.
Exactly. I'd wonder, why am I on a date with Mark Bittman? That's weird.
At the same time, good wine or classically good wine is completely unaffordable. So it becomes kind of irrelevant because it doesn't make any difference to anybody. I mean, it only makes a difference to real wine geeks and rich people.
Barack Obama supporters. I think it's good news also because I think there's a certain amount of pretentiousness that goes along with wine tasting and it takes the pressure off, like Mark said. I mean, there are more important things. I think if you like it, you like it. And if it happens to be a cheaper bottle of wine, well, who are we to judge?
Gould?
I'm a non-drinker and I couldn't know less about this subject. My favorite food is the 3 cents a ton fried chicken at our grocery store. It's sort of the same thing as like when you the drawings of a cat versus the drawings of postmodern surrealists. It's all subjective. But I did want to tip my hat to Tara and I'm not being sarcastic. I mean this seriously. I'm really not. I do find it fascinating. The Republicans are so much better than the Democrats at everything. And the way they've somehow labeled Democrats as effete snobs. The people whose movement was founded by William F. Buckley Jr. point the snob finger at the other team, down home, truck driving, bib overall wearing William F. Buckley Jr. with his corn cob pipe. I tip my hat.
Tara, his hat's been tipped toward in your direction.
I see. And I'm actually going to let that one go.
Yeah. Okay.
That's for another discussion.
Our next topic. A Washington Post columnist reminded readers with small kids to childproof their homes. Lots of readers wrote back to say, what happened to discipline? When we were kids, we didn't go into the places we were told not to go. Childproofing through discipline. Good news, bad news, or not news?
As the father of two very young children, I can tell you, their primary job is to kill themselves, and your job is to stop them.
Yeah, isn't that funny when we're supposed to be survivors?
If you had, like, a room full of unicorn ponies, like a fish tank full of active fairies,
yes,
and in the corner a discarded nail gun, they beeline to that nail gun.
Unless they could figure out how to impale themselves on the unicorn pony.
Exactly. Kids dangling limply off unicorns' foreheads.
That's disturbing. Others?
My kids are grown, and I haven't been through this in a long time, but I guess I'd be in favor of one child-proofed cabinet per house, and that would be the one, again, you know, where the poor Drano, what a bad rap it gets. But
I know.
Anyway.
Sorry, Drano.
Just because if you drink it, your esophagus falls out. But, you know, there's nothing more annoying as an adult than to go to somebody's house and every single, the doorknobs have those slippery things on them so you can't open the door.
Well,
you know, there is such a thing as overdoing it.
I think this is bad news in a certain respect because, I mean, for goodness sakes, it's just plain common sense here. We over-medicate our kids, you know, we do the timeout thing, and, you know, sometimes we don't want to discipline our children at all, afraid they're going to have low self-esteem, and then they, you know, turn out to be, you know, out of control, spoiled brats. It's common sense. I mean, for goodness sakes.
I would just wonder how many people are on this sort of overprotective thing just so that the kids leave them alone, which
well,
is, to me is not a real good reason.
I happen to agree with you on that.
As the only person in this panel in the middle of this stage of child rearing, I will remind you, you have to watch them every second, and that is rarely possible.
But come on, generations before us, they were able to do it, and we were in the middle of wars and depression and everything else, and they, you know, they turned out all right.
The word you're looking for is playpen.
But that's a bit of a specious argument. Abe Lincoln ran the Civil War without a BlackBerry. How is that possible?
I saw someone the other day who had a leash on her kid.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, this is going too far.
I've seen that, and it is grim. Unless it's like at a crazy busy airport, and then I can almost understand it. But if it's possible to lowjack my girls when they're 14, that chip's going right in the back of their neck.
Probably will be, actually. Yeah.
That's the news panel. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was great. A lot of fun, Bill.
Thanks, Bill.
That was political consultant Tara Settmeyer, writer Dana Gould. His credits include The Simpsons, and Mark Bittman. He writes the New York Times weekly column The Minimalist, and he's the author of How to Cook Everything, Simple Recipes for Great Food. So what did you think was good news, bad news, or no news this week? Let us know at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
This weekend is for you, Mom, as long as you behave like we want you to. A son wakes up to an insubordinate mother coming up on Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. Des Cooper's away. I'm Bill Radke. I'm glad I get to talk with you every weekend, even if it is one way. It seems like our chances for actual conversation have dwindled. Here in Los Angeles, there aren't many public squares. The commutes are long. The houses are detached. Andrew Simmons grew up in rural Idaho. When he moved to Southern California, Orange County, he couldn't get used to the anonymity of big city life. So every other Saturday, including this one, he sets up a tent and tables and chairs on a busy corner, and he invites passersby to sit and to enjoy his free conversation booth. Weekend America's E. Okobie spent a day with Andrew, and the first thing he did was lay down the law about how to have a free conversation.
All right, so we have no drink alcohol at the booth. Don't be creepy. And parenthetically, it says, includes sexual advances towards other conversationalists. Conduct yourself positively toward people passing the booth. This is an old one that I just haven't deleted. Don't abuse the free soda offerings. So now these are actually written in pen because these are recent, you know. No selling any products, especially, and this is underlined, pyramid schemes. Okay. And the one below that is no religious preaching. So those are the rules, all made for reasons.
This is like my fourth time coming by. When I first came, he had a paper sign. And I see now that he's moved up in the world because it's a nice printed sign, all professional.
When you see someone walking down a street, I always wonder what their story is, you know? I wonder, like, what do their kids think of them? What are they doing right now? What's going through their mind? What are their ambitions in life? And to actually be in a venue where you can figure that out from complete strangers is something really empowering to some people.
But histories like that are repeated and repeated.
Yes.
But here's the more fundamental is that why there's this really strong need among different societies to have belief and to hold it to the exclusion of all other beliefs.
My first free conversation booth was about 6 months ago, and it was scary. I'm not going to lie. I got a booth, and I got a bunch of chairs, and I came out here, and I sat here for something like about 20 or 30 minutes, just sitting there just looking at people, and no one was stopping, so I kind of had to start calling on people, and I was like, hey, you know, free conversation.
Did you spend time in Alaska?
I worked in the pipeline.
Oh, really?
You'd wake up, and you'd hear, can you see stars? And if they came back cussing and cursing, you knew they could see stars.
Why, it's so beautiful?
No, that meant that it was going to be a cold day. Because if you had clouds, you were not going to be that cold.
Clouds don't begin it.
A lot of times they'll try to figure out what the scam is. That's like the big game.
Seriously, though, what's your guys' agenda?
A lot of people just can't accept the fact that there isn't an angle. It's really just to get to know people. I get an awesome story, and I get a glimpse into someone's life.
I came by because I was very curious about the free conversation. I just wanted to see if there was something that he was selling, or if this was his thesis. Or
no, I just wanted to get people talking with each other more.
I'm a senior at high school, and I'm not exactly the best person with girls. Now, don't make fun of me, because I can admit I have a problem with girls, so, you know.
When you can actually hear someone else's story and hear what they're going through and see how similar it is to your own trials, it's really empowering, you know? You say, like, wow, you know, this person made it. This person's doing fine. And it gives you a different kind of perspective on all your problems.
You know, I'm actually right now, like, on a blind date from, like, the internet. And one thing I've learned is there's a lot of people out there that just don't talk to each other. Like, there's, like, no alcohol here. You know, it's not like a club. So you can just sit down and, like, talk to people, like, what's up, you know? So it's cool.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see it as giving up a Saturday. Like, I see sitting at home and watching TV as giving up a Saturday. But going down somewhere and actually understanding people and actually giving people a way to communicate what they're feeling and what they're going through, I mean, that's definitely not giving up a Saturday to me. That's something that I look forward to.
Andrew will be chatting in Belmont Shore this weekend until 2 a.m., as long as people are there to chat. You can also eavesdrop on the conversations at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Des Cooper is away this weekend. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. The weekend is what this show is about. We went looking for stories to mark this Mother's Day weekend. Producer Sandon Totten sent us a tale about growing pains, specifically his mom's growing pains as she closed in on her 50th birthday. Kids were grown. Sandon was the only one living at home. She was restless at her job, changing her hairstyle every other week. Sandon says all the signs were there, and he still had no idea what was coming next.
It happened one day after school. I came home and I opened the garage and there I saw this motorcycle. I mean, like a big angry looking thing just parked right there sneering at our white minivan. I ran upstairs shocked, and in the kitchen, both my parents were laughing at me.
Yes, we did think it was pretty funny the way you said, "Holy shit, there's a bike in our garage." Poor Sandon looked so astonished.
Okay, that's my mom. And I was astonished. Because it was her bike. All my life, she was the one lecturing me about thinking through my actions. And here she was with the keys to some crotch rocket, all because of a midlife crisis. Whatever. The point was, motorcycles are dangerous. Every day, an average of 12 Americans wipes out riding one of these death traps. And buying one is the kind of impulsive, irresponsible thing I'd expect from someone young and stupid. Like me. Not my mom.
It certainly was an impulse, but I don't think it was all that irresponsible. I was very careful. I wore a whole lot more protection than most folks would.
That's true. She did get everything from a full-face helmet to fire socks. But any way you look at it, this was a big decision. What gave her the right to just do this on her own without even consulting her family?
I felt like I had earned the right to do that. I also felt that I had denied myself for a long time for the sake of my family, and I deserved it. I actually bought something that was fun for me.
All right. She makes a good point. And truthfully, she was going to ride this thing no matter what I said. My only hope was that it was just a passing phase. It wasn't a passing phase. My mom bought a full leather outfit. She started cutting the sleeves off her t-shirts. She even joined a biker gang. Okay, so it was a biker gang for doctors and lawyers, so less six-packs and brass knuckles and more briefcases and bifocals. But still, it was kind of cool. My mom was like Peter Fonda in Easy Rider, except short, middle-aged, and wearing lipstick. It was the happiest I'd seen her in years. So when she announced to our family that she was going to take a cross-country trip on her bike, I decided to show her some support. I asked to ride along on the back. Of course, she said yes, she's my mom. So we packed up our stuff in two saddlebags and we hit the open road. We started out on the West Coast. It was summer, so it was hot.
Really hot. About 105, 110 at least.
But when we reached the Rockies, things cooled down. My mom's bike had no trouble climbing those hills.
And then we came out of the Rockies and all this incredibly beautiful scenery. And
we were swooping and swooshing down the roadway.
Downhill towards Denver and down and down. And suddenly we hit the city and out of the city on the other side.
And then nothing. It was flat and boring for miles. We rode on late into the night without stopping. And before we knew it, we ran out of gas. None of this fazed my mom. She just parked the bike and went out into the middle of a deserted field. We sat there and just looked up at the stars. My mom told me about how when she was my age, she used to dream of crossing the country, like in the book, On the Road. She said this trip kind of fulfilled that dream for her.
I was very happy to be doing that. It was a time when we were sharing similar interests and a little adventure together. I think of it as one of the best times I've ever had on a bike.
Then the accident. It was a couple months later. My mom was heading to work one day, and the bike just slid out from under her in the middle of a turn. She survived it okay, but her knee was busted pretty badly, and the bike was totaled. Now, here's the point where I should have freaked out. I should have put my foot down and said, "Mom, no more motorcycles. It's time you give it up." But the truth was, I didn't want to see her give it up. I'd gotten used to this new mom. Biking gave her a sense of purpose. It gave her confidence, and it gave her life outside of just her job and her family. 2 months later, she bought a new bike. This one was even bigger and shinier than the first. Before I knew it, she was back on the road. And you know what? I'm okay with that. As long as she wears her helmet.
That's producer Sandin Totten. Sandin's mom, by the way, is an ER doctor. And she's going to be working this weekend. And she hopes to get in some riding and garage sailing. Last weekend, she hit a couple of yard sales and managed to get back home with a 6-foot rolled-up tapestry strapped to her bike. Throttle on, Dr. Totten! Crucial Democratic primaries were held this week in Indiana and North Carolina. Senator Barack Obama emerged with renewed momentum. Many voters said they separated Obama from the inflammatory views of his former pastor, Jeremiah Wright. In a news conference, Obama soundly denounced the man who had conducted his wedding ceremony and baptized his children. Last week, we asked you if you remembered a time when your spiritual leader surprised or shocked you. We wanted to know how you dealt with it and why. Bronwyn West lives in Winter Park, Florida, and she couldn't believe what her priest was saying from the pulpit.
It was Christmas Mass about 2 or 3 years ago, and in the middle of the homily, which is kind of the main body of the sermon, the priest told an anti-Semitic joke. I think he was trying to use it to segue into what the message was for the day, which was about going to any length to find a connection with God. The whole congregation, which was 1,000-plus people, standing room only, laughed for about 3 or 4 seconds and stopped. And it just, the joke kind of hung there. And it was very obvious that people weren't amused, you know, that it was, there was kind of a collective impression that this wasn't appropriate for church. And consequently, the priest came back the following Sunday and apologized. And I didn't speak to him personally. I'm not sure who did. I think I didn't say anything to the priest about the joke because I don't know. I don't really know that I thought it was my place to. But it did make me examine what I do and what I find funny.
Lots of listeners wrote in to tell us how they left their church over disagreements. But one listener facing a difference of opinion with his minister actually decided to stay.
My name is Roy Young, and I live in St. Louis, Missouri.
Roy attends a Baptist congregation, same church he's been going to for 20 years. A few years ago, his pastor brought in a local politician who was pro-choice. Roy didn't understand why his pastor would allow this candidate to speak at his church.
I wasn't upset with my pastor, but I was confused how he could take those positions. In the end of our conversation, basically, my pastor agreed to disagree with me. I didn't leave my church. You wouldn't leave your church because of a disagreement, the same reason why you wouldn't leave your family because of some disagreement over something.
Marion Hale from Evanston, Illinois, told us about a time when she found enlightenment from a disagreement with her spiritual leader.
I was about 13, and in high school at that point, we studied the history of the British Empire. And that year, the emphasis was on India. I read about Hinduism. I read about reincarnation. And then I read about Mahatma Gandhi, and I was so impressed with this gentle, very intelligent man who did wonderful things for his people. And as I thought more about it, I got very bothered about being a Christian. So I went to my minister in the little Anglican church, and I said, "Sir, I'd like to ask you a question, if you don't mind." And he said, "No, what's that?" And I said, "You know the part in the Bible that said God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that all who believe on him should have eternal life? Well, that kind of implies that anybody who doesn't is going to hell." And I said, "Well, what about this man I've just been reading about named Gandhi? He wasn't Christian. He was Hindu. As a Christian, do I have to believe, and I remember I used this phrase, do I have to believe that he's roasting in hell?" And the minister got very serious, swallowed hard. I think he thought that I was going to ask him a pretty simple question. And he said, "Yes, Marion." I think in that moment in time, I was a little angry with him. But when I look back on it, I realize that he didn't try to find a fluffy answer. He stayed in his integrity, and he answered me from that place. And I respect him for that. That meeting I had with my minister when I was 13 years old changed my thinking and freed me up to be doing exactly what I'm doing today. An interfaith wedding minister.
This weekend, Marion is meeting with couples to talk about summer wedding ceremonies. Thank you to everybody who wrote into us. You can read about more surprising moments between listeners and their faith leaders at weekendamerica.org. From Kansas to Texas, strong thunderstorms and hail are visiting this weekend. Here's more weekend weather with Brendan Noonan.
You can't appreciate the sweet without the bitter, says Boston, Massachusetts, at its Bitter Melon Festival today. The weather should give attendees something extra to be bitter about in the form of scattered showers. If it makes you feel better, Boston, I think it's totally unfair that I have to spend my weekend cramped inside this teensy dark radio receiver describing all the fun everyone else is having. Do chains, grease, and tight shorts get you worked up? Then head to New York City for Bike Fetish Day. I won't judge you, but others might. There'll be prizes for the most tricked-out bicycles. A chance of showers means possible wet streets, so try to keep your eyes on the road. And if you go, make sure your bike has toe clips. Can't explain it, but they always drive me crazy. No man is an island, but Hawaii is. Fortunately, instead of spending this weekend pondering how we are all fundamentally alone in this cruel world, the Aloha State will be celebrating love at the Hawaii Romance Festival in Honolulu, where it will be a dreamy 85 degrees and sunny. Visitors are invited to ponder whether romance is like a long walk on the beach or a simmering volcano of hot molten lava ready to explode and destroy them at any moment. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Brendan Noonan for Weekend America.
Coming up next, the race is not always to the swift, not when you're on a tractor. Partial speed ahead on Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org.
This is Weekend America. Des Cooper is away this week. I'm Bill Radke. This next story takes place in Boscobel, Wisconsin, population 3,000, where last weekend the Southwest Wisconsin Two-Cylinder Club held its annual show. The stars of the show were antique John Deere tractors. See, John Deere quit making two cylinders about 50 years ago. So there was a plowing demonstration and a parade, but we were most intrigued by the tractor races. Independent producer Lynn Milner takes us right into the pulse-reducing action.
In Boscobel City Park, two tractors are racing, very slowly. That's the point. The object is to see who can go the slowest without killing their engine. Three tractors have already crossed the finish line, so they've lost. We're down to two. They're matching each other putt for putt with 20 yards to go. The one you're hearing is the one to beat, a 1947 John Deere B. It's bright green with large rear tires ready to cover some ground. A metal smokestack rises from its hood. Driving this tractor is Melvin Main. The John Deere lurches a little each time it inches forward, rocking Melvin gently in the cushioned seat. He's keeping his hand close to the gas lever in case he needs to give it a tap. He sees something that concerns him, a cloud rising from the exhaust pipe.
I don't like that black smoke coming out of it. It means she's loading up.
Seems okay for now. You know, we have some time. This isn't exactly NASCAR, so let me describe the scene. We're standing on a green lawn filled with yellow dandelions. The green and yellow match the John Deere's perfectly. In fact, the guys in the two-cylinder club asked the city not to mow the dandelions before the show. Boscobel is so small, you could walk from one end to the other in 20 minutes. The closest interstate is 80 miles away. Let's get back to the race. Melvin's tractor's moved about 2 feet. It's still running, but he looks nervous. He nudges the gas lever with the heel of his hand, but it's too late. His engine dies. The judge, Jeff Adams, makes the official pronouncement.
Uh-oh! Oh. He just lost. He's going to go home crying now.
Devin Updike won. He had a newer tractor, a 1958 John Deere 630. There are only four people watching, but these guys don't care. They just want to play with their tractors.
Why do you think these guys love tractors so much?
It's in our blood. It's just something we like to see carried on.
Do you think it'll be carried on?
Well, no, I don't know.
That's Dan Davies. He drives a 1947 Model B. Like most of the guys in the club, he's retired. Years ago, this was a farmer's town. It's not so much anymore. Now, to make a profit at farming, you need a lot of land and equipment. For this reason, about 15 years ago, the town of Boscobel started courting big industry. Steve Wetter is the former mayor. He helped make it happen.
Our industrial park on any given day has 1,000 people working out there. So we have, of course, this is where the Supermax prison is. The tools are here to do today's work, which we have to do. If you don't keep up, you're going to get left behind.
Which makes me think of the guys in the slow tractor race. The whole point is to be left behind. The guys in the club grew up on farms, with the putt-putt of tractor engines, the smell of fresh milk. Many of them have kept tractors that belong to their fathers.
In 52, my dad bought a 51. It was a Ford tractor, and I drove that home from the dealer. I was 15.
Art Freimiller still has that tractor, even after his dad's accident. One day, his father took the tractor out of gear to adjust something.
And he stepped off and it started rolling down the waterway, and he ran after it. And he apparently tripped and fell down, and it ran across his chest. And that's how I found him.
You found him?
Yeah, I found him. And there was nothing to be done for him. But it wasn't the tractor's fault. You know, it was just one of them things that happened.
Art sold his farm last month. That tractor's in decent shape. He restored it a few years after his dad passed away. Art owns 27 tractors, worth a small fortune, but he has no plans to ever sell them. The most valuable tractor in Boscobel is not at the show. It's a 1920 Waterloo Boy. It's three blocks away, sitting in a store basement. Sam Nelson inherited the Waterloo Boy from his dad, along with 21 other John Deeres. He works at the prison. Sam's father grew up on a farm and collected tractors until he died.
For some reason, he got what they call green fever. And as you can see, that's he kept growing and growing.
The Waterloo Boy is just inside the door. It has yellow spoke wheels with red hubcaps the size of buttons, large green fenders. It's the first tractor model ever sold by John Deere. It's worth $87,000. When Sam's dad died 3 years ago, they started it up and parked it at the funeral home so everyone could see it. Sam and his mother are auctioning off the entire collection on Memorial Day. That probably means that most of them will leave Boscobel. The last two Waterloo boys were bought by investors in the Netherlands.
It's time to let them go. They haven't been started for a good 2 years, and it's not good for them just to be setting. We're sure that they'll go to good homes, and that's all that really matters. And it's time to move forward.
In Boscobel, Wisconsin, I'm Lynn Milner for Weekend America.
This weekend, the big events in Boscobel, by the way, Krogan's Hardware and Appliance, celebrating 75 years in business. The Amish hold a Mother's Day auction, and turkey hunting, turkey hunting, turkey hunting. This is American Public Media's Weekend America. So glad you spent another hour with us. Our show is produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Jim Gates, Millie Jefferson, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Tim Bomba, and Michael Rayfield, who will be riding bikes in the Santa Monica Mountains this weekend. Also Angela Kim, Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Chrissy Clark's taking her little brother to the zoo this weekend, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, and David Banks headed to Laguna Beach to see the Missiles of October, best unknown band ever, he claims. And Phyllis Owens, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez, who's taking a gardening class this weekend to learn about Minnesota's native grasses. That's his new home. Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the program, and you can get a free podcast of it at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke, and Desiree Cooper will be back with us next week. It's your weekend. Enjoy it.
Weekend America is supported by Gather.com, where people can stay in touch with who they know and what they love. You can discover unsigned musicians, discuss books, share pictures, and keep up with the world. People are talking. Gather.com. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul. And made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
This is Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for courage.
Yeah, when you come in here and you see a whole bunch of people in there, hey, they go Pookie, they go Mikey. You know, I didn't expect to see him here. They make you kind of feel like, okay, well, if they're going to do it, then I can do it.
Conquering errands, braving to-do lists, listening to the most memorable stories and ideas every Saturday. Weekend America. Join us.